Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A year into the pandemic, the most pressing question about COVID still remains unanswered. What is the pinpoint origin of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID? Well, a WHO-led mission to Wuhan, China earlier this year investigated the leading hypotheses around COVID's origin. The WHO's report suggests that the most likely scenario is via an intermediate animal host, possibly a wild animal captured and then raised on a farm. Peter Daszak, one of the investigators who helped write the report, told NPR today that it's possible the pandemic's origins began long before early known cases associated with the Huanan seafood market in Wuhan.
Well, what we're really saying is we don't know exactly whether the Huanan seafood market in Wuhan was the source or not. It still could be, but it's also possible that other places within the region were the origin, the place where the virus first got into people. In fact, you know, we've traced back from that market that the suppliers of food to the market, which includes wildlife, from all across China, including places in rural China where we know the nearest viruses in bats, for instance, exist. And it may have started there.
The WHO insists, however, that its findings are preliminary and not conclusive. The mission, though, was hampered by politics from the start. Investigators were allowed into Wuhan only under the aegis of the Chinese government. They were given 1 month to conduct their research, half of which was spent in quarantine. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has expressed concerns about the report's validity.
We've got real concerns about the methodology and the process that went into that report, including the fact that the government in Beijing apparently helped to write it. But let's see what comes out in that report.
So methodology and processes, politics and transparency. We are particularly interested in how you do solid science that reliably informs the public about the origins of a deadly pandemic. So we're going to turn to two veteran virus hunters, Susan Fisher-Hawk and Joseph McCormick. They're professors of epidemiology, human genetics, and environmental sciences at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. They contributed significantly to early understanding of Lassa viruses and Ebola as well. They've had long careers with the CDC investigating level 4 viruses and are co-authors of Level 4, Virus Hunters of the CDC, Tracking Ebola and the World's Deadliest Viruses. Professor Fisher-Hawk, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Professor McCormick. Yeah, welcome to you as well, Professor McCormick.
Thank you.
So first of all, let's just start with a really basic question, then we'll dive into what we know thus far about the WHO's findings. And Professor Fisher-Hawk, I'll just start with you. Why is it so vitally important to understand as well as we can or pinpoint the exact origins of a new viral disease?
It's absolutely critical because this is the only way you can stop it happening again. It's not, retrospectively, there's not much you can do. It's happened. But what happened before may happen again. And you can be prepared and you can stop it the second time.
Mm. So it's a critical knowledge for the future well-being of humanity, if I could just put it bluntly like that way. So that's why, especially for SARS-CoV-2, because this is the first global pandemic we've had in a century, this question is incredibly pressing. So let me just ask both of you, and first I'll turn to you, Professor McCormick. I know that perhaps you haven't had a chance to dive in deeply to the 123-page report, but do you think that the WHO's mission was sort of doomed from the start, given that it seemed like researchers were rather limited in what they could do in their search for SARS-CoV-2's origins?
Well, there's no question it was limited. And let's look at what it is that we would need in order to arrive at some kind of reasonable conclusion about its potential origin. What we're really doing is comparing viruses. And I put it, there are two analogies to this. If you send off your specimen to an ancestry company that does DNA and sends you back a report, they're comparing your DNA sequence with a whole bank of data that relate to ethnicity, to geography, lots of other things. And that's how they tell you what your ancestry. Secondly, law enforcement uses a similar kind of technology to look at the source of, say, blood or other specimens and tracking them back to a human. Well, in this case, we want to compare the fingerprint, that the genetic fingerprint of viruses. And so ideally, what the WHO group would have liked to have had would be viruses that were working, being worked on in the laboratory there, viruses obviously from the epidemic, and viruses, and look for viruses in that particular market and perhaps elsewhere. And that may be something that happens, but right now we don't have that kind of data. And without that, it's going to be kind of he said, without really any conclusive information. So the science has the potential to try to pinpoint this, but we don't have the kind of data yet that's really needed.
So Professor Fisher Hawk, I mean, when Professor McCormick says without those key sets of data, this is a he said report. I mean, is there any utility to what the WHO did at all?
Absolutely. Okay. You can get pretty close. I think the absolute proof, as Dr. McCormick said, is in being able to pinpoint the genetic sequences, the fingerprints. But, a year after it happened, it's too late to be able to find the original culprit. And I think that is the problem.
Well, so here's at least part of what we know they did look at in their month in Wuhan, again, half of which was spent in quarantine. But we have reports here that says the working group examined identifying earlier cases of COVID through surveillance and morbidity data that came out of Wuhan in late 2019. National Sentinel surveillance data, laboratory confirmations of disease, reports of retail pharmacy purchases, cold and cough medications, things like that. I'm not necessarily seeing here the kind of specific sort of genetic hunt you were talking about, Professor McCormick.
Well, therein lies the problem, because these are all indirect measures. What they've really shown is that probably, undoubtedly, the outbreak originated there. I don't think there's a lot of doubt about that. But that doesn't tell you where the specific virus came from. Now, we have a small clue in the fact that the original SARS virus occurred in the same place and was spread less so, but globally. So that certainly raises your suspicion that something was going on in that market. And for that point of view, I think that there's a lot of credibility that the WHO is saying that likely came from that market. Well, we have an example of that. But where we need to go beyond that is to go back and say what animals are being brought to that market. And even going back into the sources of where those animals come from, one might find a virus highly related to the virus that is circulating now. And it's possible, again, through comparing viruses, to get a pretty good clue about what happened. And I use an example of what happened when the Ebola virus outbreak in West Africa, where Dr. Sabaty from the Broad Institute in Boston actually was able to track, using again these virus sequences, the spread of virus from Guinea next door into Sierra Leone. And so she used again the sequence of viruses in comparison. So that's another example of where you can use that to get the hard evidence that we need about where this virus may have come from. So going out and looking into bats, into other animals, intermediate animals, is a really important point. Even today, even though we're a year away, it's still important, because that could help us find a potential trail to look back at where this may have come from.
Okay, so, but help me understand something here, because, again, from a layperson's perspective, I guess what I want to know is, did any of that kind of investigation, did the WHO mission have the chance to do that? I mean, they do say that they looked at what's called a convenient subset of stored samples of more than 4,500 research project samples from the second half of 2019, stored at various hospitals in Wuhan and the rest of Hubei province. I mean, I'm not exactly sure what that even means, but would that give you the kind of genetic material that you'd need to do the investigation that you just described?
So if this is material that comes from patients and you could isolate the viruses from those, you could go back a long way to, again, get the virus fingerprints and start to understand where, how this might have gotten started, what was the original virus that was seen in humans, and that would give you a lot of information, important information. So if people have access to that and they can actually share it with laboratories, hopefully independent laboratories that would analyze it, it could give us a lot of insight into how this originated and how the virus may have even changed over those early days.
Okay, but the WHO is clear about something, that they say that the closest related viruses to SARS-CoV-2 have been found in bats, but they're also talking about what they call an evolutionary distance of decades, several decades, suggesting that there's this missing link, some intermediate zoonotic link between what might be those bats and how COVID then gets a foothold amongst human beings. So, Professor Fisher-Hawk, what does that tell you? Professor, I'll turn back to you. Professor McCormick, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, looks like we lost Susan Fisher-Hawk's line. We'll try to get her right back. But you heard that question. So what does that suggest to you, this gap of several evolutionary gap of several decades?
Well, we know that sometimes viruses can move into other species. And so that begs the question even more to go back and look at the source of animals that were being brought to the market, because it's entirely possible that this virus jumped from a bat to other animals. For example, we know that this virus has gotten into mink. It's gotten into certain cat species, into dogs, even during this epidemic. And these have all been reported in various places. So it's entirely possible that the virus jumped from a bat some time ago into a group of animals, and that we are, and that we need to go back and look and try to find the trail for this. And so that's what it says to me.
Well, we are talking with two veteran virus hunters about what is still unknown about the origins of the COVID pandemic. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about trying to pinpoint the origin of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that's caused the worldwide COVID pandemic. And I'm joined today by two veteran virus hunters, Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk. They worked for decades on viruses such as the one that causes loss of fever and Ebola, had long careers with the CDC. They're now professors of epidemiology, human genetics, and environmental sciences at the University of Texas. Now, you know, we should note that the WHO's report following their mission earlier this year in Wuhan, China, insists that the report is preliminary and not conclusive. But there are some interesting things that are coming out of what the WHO is saying, that, for example, transmission within the wider community in Wuhan in December could account for cases that are not actually associated with that Huanan market. And together with the presence of earlier cases not associated with that market could suggest that the market was, in fact, not the original source of the outbreak. Really interesting that sampling at the market turned up the virus on surfaces, but not in samples taken from animals or food sold at the market. So, Professor McCormick, let me just quickly turn to you. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that we know this virus spreads very easily. So whatever the source might have been at the market, it could have put it out into other areas through the air, just like it does with humans. Or it could have shown that people were coming to the market who were already infected and spread it in the market. So it's difficult to say exactly what that means. Again, if you could compare the virus found at the market with those people in the earliest part of the epidemic and really do this the sequencing, that should give you a pretty good clue. And I don't see that in the I don't see that kind of hard data in the report. So I think that again, it's circumstantial evidence, but also it's awfully difficult, no matter how good your tracing is, to really connect all the cases. So trying to find some people, I'm sure they found some people who were at the market. That doesn't mean it's a smoking gun in terms of that's where it came from. And they probably found some people that didn't have contact with the market, but we don't know who else they had contact with. So again, this is circumstantial evidence. It's interesting, but we really need the hard data.
So this keeps coming up over and over again. Circumstantial, a lack of hard data, some of the basic questions that you would want to ask can't be answered until we get that data. So then, Professor Fischer-Hawk, let me turn to you here. What do you make of the WHO asserting that even in the absence of said data, they are saying that it's extremely unlikely that there is a laboratory origin to SARS-CoV-2?
Yes, this would be very difficult to do. There are certain pieces of evidence that have kind of leaked out slowly. Not direct evidence, but hearsay, that nobody in the lab ever got infected with COVID. Well, they may have been asymptomatically infected. We don't know, and it's Chinese sources for the information. So again, we don't know. But it would be very difficult to engineer a virus like this and to release it into the public without damaging your own people. And this is really the argument against biowarfare. Unless you already have an effective vaccine, as you do with smallpox, you don't do it because you're going to kill your own people first.
So, but respectfully, Professor Fischer-Hawk, if I might interject here, isn't that exactly what happened? I mean, people in China died. Right?
Exactly. So it makes no sense that that's what they did. But on the other hand, it's much more probable that what happened with the first SARS outbreak happened again. And so it's a question of probabilities here.
Okay. But
Dr. McCormick is right. Yeah, sorry.
No, please go ahead. Finish.
Dr. McCormick is right. The hard evidence is molecular. But molecular evidence has only been available to us for the last 40 or 50 years. So we'd always had to use circumstantial evidence before. And it gets you about 80-90% of the way, but the hard evidence, the 90%, depends on the fingerprint.
But is it good science to at least offer a form of a conclusion, as we've been seeing, that it's extremely unlikely, the WHO says, of a laboratory origin in the absence of the data that you're talking about? Is it good science to even offer that conclusion?
Well, it is. But on the other hand, you know, the other element you always have to put into this is common sense. What is the most likely and most probable thing? And that is the reason why they come out and say it is most likely without saying it actually happened. It's because they haven't got that last piece that they can put in and say, oh, yes, this definitely happened. And this is one of the problems with science and talking to the public. The public want definitive answers. You know, it's black or it's white. And in science, you can get so far, and it's very complicated, and there are lots of different hypotheses, and you have to follow them all. But to actually come down and say, yes, this is what actually happened, you need the gun as well as the smoking gun and the bullet. Mm. You see what I mean?
I do. Professor McCormick, go ahead.
So I was going to comment that it is possible if we actually had, first of all, were coronaviruses being worked on in that laboratory? Almost certainly, but let's look at what happens around the globe. There are coronaviruses worked on all over the globe in laboratories. There are Ebola viruses worked on in laboratories all over the world. So the fact that a laboratory is doing research on viruses is not anything particularly concerning because that happens all over the world. So the question is, were they working with coronaviruses, yes or no? And secondly, could we have a sample of those coronaviruses you were working with to compare with the virus that's circulating? And that would go a long way. Now, has that question been asked and they refused? I don't know the answer to that, and I don't think it's in the WHO report. So that's a key question, because if you had the viruses being worked on in the lab and they were open source and you could compare them, then you could say, well, yeah, this could have been possibly an inadvertent. This virus spreads very easily. It doesn't have to be released deliberately. It could have been almost certainly it would have been inadvertent. And we've seen some inadvertent releases of viruses, for example. Ebola virus in Russia during some experiments done in a laboratory there many years ago.
So isn't that the thing? Science can ask the questions, but it's politics that's preventing us from getting the answers. So Professors McCormick and Fisher-Hawk, stand by for just a second, because I want to turn now to Jamie Metzl, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, former National Security Council official in the Clinton administration, and advisor to the WHO on human genome editing. Jamie Metzl, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So do you have concerns about the WHO's impartiality in undertaking this investigation?
So I don't have, I don't have concerns about the WHO, but we need to be clear about what this process is and what it's not. It's not an investigation, and it's not being carried out by the WHO. It's not an investigation because the leaders of this joint study team have said that it's not. They only had the international team only had 2 weeks on the ground in Wuhan. They had a highly curated, carefully managed study tour. And it's not the WHO because this report is being released by a joint study group of this WHO organized independent expert group and their Chinese government counterparts. But the actual report that they have released is highly credible in its examination of the possible of a zoonotic event, a jump through intermediate animal hosts in the wild. They've actually done a quite thorough job, probably maybe even more than is necessary, exploring the possibility of a frozen food transmission. And they appear to have totally bent over backwards to try to justify those two possibilities in spite of the very clear lack of evidence. And the Chinese authorities, they have done lots of sequencing of animals all around China and haven't found that evidence. But this joint study group completely dismisses what I see as the very real possibility that this pandemic began with an accidental lab incident, and they didn't even bother to investigate it. And the reason is that they just couldn't, based on the highly restrictive terms of reference. So it's not an investigation. And it didn't look at all of the hypotheses. Dr. Fisher-Hawk was right. Real science requires examining all hypotheses. And this process did not do that.
But she also talked about common sense and knowledge of what we know about, you know, other coronaviruses or SARS or past diseases that may have then been part of the tools that the WHO's report brought together to offer this extremely unlikely conclusion that the group came to.
So common sense must apply here. And so if you're examining the zoonotic hypothesis, common sense suggests that most pathogenic outbreaks in the past have happened through this pathway of a reservoir host and then transmission through intermediate hosts and then ultimately infecting humans. So that must be a very serious possibility. But common sense also would force us to ask the question of where does this come from? And we know that the backbone virus very likely stems from horseshoe bats in southern China. And this outbreak didn't happen in southern China. We didn't see any evidence of it in any kind of pathway, any kind of route between southern China and central China, 1,000 miles away. But what we do know is that in Wuhan, of all the towns in all the world, there's China's only level 4 virology institute with the world's largest collection of bat coronaviruses doing highly aggressive gain of function research with a spotty security record that had collected samples from a mine in southern China where the RATG13 virus, which is the closest genetic relative to SARS-CoV-2, was sampled. And to Dr. McCormick's point, we also know from day one, the Chinese authorities were destroying samples, hiding exactly the kind of databases that Dr. McCormick says that we need. They exist. They just haven't been shared. They've been imprisoning journalists asking tough questions. And there's a universal gag order on Chinese scientists preventing them from saying or publishing anything about the origins of the pandemic without prior approval by the Chinese government. So logic must apply, but it has to apply in all directions.
Well, we have also this January State Department statement from the United States that several, this is again from the U.S. State Department, that several researchers at the lab became sick with a COVID-like illness in the fall of 2019. And according to the State Department, which also is inflected, if I can say, at the very least, with politics, the statement goes on, the Wuhan Institute of Virology had a separate military-run lab and that the lab, quote, altered and then removed online records of its work. But Peter Daszak, who was a member of the WHO team that went to Wuhan in January and February, he was asked yesterday on PBS's NewsHour about whether he was confident if the information that the WHO mission got from the Chinese scientists regarding the Wuhan lab, if he was confident in that information and whether or not he would know if those scientists were lying.
Yeah, I've been speaking to them for 15 years. You know, if they'd have found a virus that was a high of high interest that they were working on, they would have told me before the outbreak, because that's what we were doing before the outbreak. We shared information on a weekly basis. Yes, some of them answer up the party chain, but they also are scientists. If there is something that the intelligence agencies know that they could supply to the WHO team, then supply it, and we will look at that.
Professor Fisher-Hawk, respond to this. I mean, you've had long experience in these high-level containment labs. Respond to what actually you just heard Peter Daszak saying there, that he has confidence in the information coming out of the Wuhan lab.
Yes, I think at the scientist-to-scientist level, I would agree that's usually the case. But you never know what pressures are being applied behind the scenes. However, there are two incidents in the past, in the 20th century, that are coming to my mind. One is the Sverdlovsk incident, which is where the Russians were working with smallpox. And on the Friday night, somebody thought a filter needed to be changed. And they took the old filter out and forgot to put the new one in. And outside that wall where the filter vented to was the way people walked down to the, to the bars on a Friday night. And there was an outbreak of I think it was smallpox at that time. And then there's a foot and mouth disease outbreak where it escaped, in fact, from the ceiling or chimney vent in the UK and infected cows in nearby fields. So that possibility of that kind of accident does remain. Then there have been individuals in labs who have infected themselves accidentally and then gone out of the, and usually not told anybody that they'd had what might have been a frightening incident. And instead of reporting it, have gone back to their homes and communities. And very small outbreaks have occurred. So those things have happened in the past, and that kind of accident is also a possibility. Mm.
Well, Jamie Metzl, we've just got about a minute and a half left with you. I also want to note, again, while in my heart I wish this could be a purely scientific investigation, I mean, geopolitics are at the heart of this issue. If I understand correctly, the investigators only had a couple of hours themselves to spend at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. I've been playing tape from Peter Daszak. He's got a long relationship with that very lab. So I wonder if you might tell us, what are the other options? How do we get a more transparent investigation done in China? Can the WHO, does it have the tools, the policy tools or the tools via international agreement to do so?
Yeah, thanks, Meg. It's a really important question. First, Peter Daszak obviously has a monumental conflict of interest and has no business being part of this study. And what he said, the quote that you pulled, it's really something from a Monty Python skit. Did you do it? No. Okay. Sorry. I mean, what we need is a real investigation. And the problem is that the authorizing language from the original resolution from the World Health Assembly last year is limiting, and the terms of reference of the negotiation for this study were even more limiting. So what we need is a new resolution through the World Health Assembly calling for a full and unrestricted international forensic investigation. I was one of the lead authors of the open letter that outlined exactly how that should be done. I think we should be establishing a gold standard, not starting from the position of compromise.
Well, Jamie Metzl is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, former National Security Council official in the Clinton administration, and an advisor to the WHO as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
My great pleasure.
Professors McCormick and Fisher-Hawk, stand by for just a moment, because when we come back, I want to hear from you your experience in hunting very specific and deadly viruses and lessons that we ought to learn from successful searches for a disease's origin. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this hour we are talking about the still unanswered question about where SARS-CoV-2 originated, the virus that caused the global pandemic of COVID. I'm joined today by Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk. They are veteran virus hunters, professors of epidemiology, human genetics, and environmental sciences at the University of Texas, have had very long careers hunting down viral origins, and they're co-authors of the book Level 4, Virus Hunters of the CDC, Tracking Ebola and the World's Deadliest Viruses. Now, Professors McCormick and Fisher-Hawk, just hang on here with me for a little bit, because even though we talked about the lab question regarding SARS-CoV-2, I want to just stick with that for one more second, not so much vis-a-vis China, but just that, as you had said earlier, actually sort of lab accidents aren't uncommon, if I can put it that way. So consider this a little bit of a radio sidebar, just to remind us we here in the United States are not immune from mistakes. Allison Young is an investigative reporter and director, of the Missouri School of Journalism's Washington program at the University of Missouri. Now, back in 2007, she was a CDC beat reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and she began reporting on some of the most prestigious biocontainment labs in the United States.
Like most people, I have assumed that these facilities, I assumed that they were foolproof. I assumed that they were these fortresses where there were all kinds of fail-safes, and there are many layers of safety and security in these buildings, but they also are buildings that are operated by human beings, and that's where there are the potential for mistakes.
Such as in 2014 at the National Institutes of Health, their campus in Washington.
They made a shocking discovery in 2014 that there were a bunch of just old, fragile vials of old specimens in a cold storage unit. And some of those specimens contained samples of the virus that causes smallpox. And these vials were literally clinking as they were taken across the campus in a way that you know, there was a vial that broke, and luckily it was not the smallpox virus. And the person didn't get sick, and the virus was not unleashed. But those kinds of safety incidences occur on an ongoing basis. And in the United States, there are hundreds of these incidents that are reported over the past several years.
Now, to be clear, Young is not saying that the pandemic began in a lab in China. What she is saying is that it might deserve another look and that there's a need for greater accountability and transparency.
Lab safety is largely a fragmented oversight system in individual countries. When accidents happen, there is no universal and mandatory reporting of this kind of information. And almost all of these kinds of incidents in most countries are shrouded in secrecy. And that's an unfortunate thing because transparency also gives the public greater trust.
Investigative reporter Allison Young. Okay, so let's put the lab question aside for the rest of the show because Professor McCormick and Fisher Hawk, I want to learn from your real life experience. So let's talk a little bit about loss of fever, if we can, right? A sometimes deadly viral hemorrhagic illness, I believe, that was endemic to West Africa, first discovered or recognized in 1969. Can you describe a little bit about your work on loss of fever and what it took to understand where it or how it originated?
So this virus was isolated from a missionary who came with the disease loss of fever from Nigeria to a hospital in New York. And it was isolated in the laboratory at Yale University. And they were treating it like it was an arthropod-borne virus, which was what classically people did in the 1960s. And they put it into mice. And what they discovered, of course, that it was being spread, and this was not under any kind of level 4 laboratory. But the bottom line is two people got ill, one died from this. But what we discovered was the kind of virus it was, which they discovered it was an arenavirus, and this was through electron microscopy and other methods. Now, how did that give us a clue about its origin? Well, arenaviruses were well known to be viruses of rodents. And so our colleagues from the CDC and went into West Africa then a few years later, I think it was 1972, and started looking for it and found it. And they could focus on rodents. They didn't have to do a forest sweep. They didn't have to do bats and I don't know what all. They went to rodents directly. And voila, they found it in a rodent called Mastomys natalensis. And that was the way that it was found. So that was the way that Lassa virus origin was found. And, of course, we've done many studies since that time.
So they were able to pinpoint an animal reservoir rather early through the methods you just described.
Based on the type of virus, correct.
Based on the type of virus. Okay. So, what was it? In 1976, CDC actually established a Lassa fever project in Sierra Leone, and Professor McCormick, you were in charge of it.
Correct. Yes. I went to start, and we had a long longitudinal study of 15 years of the epidemiology, the clinical, and we even did a clinical trial of ribavirin, which was one of the first drugs that has shown effectiveness at treating any viral hemorrhagic fever, particularly loss of fever. So that was a highly productive period. We also developed a prototype vaccine for Lassa fever in our laboratory at the CDC.
Hmm. Now, if I'm trying to be sure I have the timeline, the chronology of our understanding of Lassa right here, that first case in 1969, but I believe subsequently it was discovered that there may have been Lassa fever for decades even earlier than when it was first recognized. Several outbreaks thereafter, but how did Professor Fisher Hawk? How did the recognition of that rodent reservoir help? What did it take to understand how it went from the rodent into human populations? Because you had those subsequent outbreaks.
Yes, and they've probably been going on in a very small way, but right across West Africa for decades, if not centuries, because this is an old virus in an old species. And so what happens in those circumstances is increase in populations of the rodents and the humans. And as that happens, they become in contact more frequently. The thing about Natalensis was to understand its ecology. And having done that, Dr. McCormick did a very interesting study looking at rodents in the field and rodents in the house, and showed quite clearly that most of the mastomys were in houses. And they are nocturnal animals. And if you go to West Africa, these are the things you observe when you go to look for clues. People, it's very hot, and they live in sometimes in just regular mud houses with straw roofs. And they don't have many windows, and they keep the doors shut or with curtains over them to keep the houses dark and cool. So you've got more or less a nocturnal environment, kind of 24/7. And, of course, the rodents love this. Not only that, you've got sources of food, and the food's not properly put away. In the evening, they cook outside round a three-stone fire, and sometimes a plate of food that's not finished is stuck underneath a bed. And then the rodents obviously have a ball and go in and out their straw mattresses and infect people. So basically, the houses end up pretty well full of virus. And so you see a lot of women are infected because they're in the houses. The children get infected, and not so much the people in the fields.
Well, is it
ecology?
Do they get infected through bites or rodent droppings?
No. Contamination in rodent urine. There's very high concentration of the virus in the urine. Of course, they pee on everything. And if you go to Africa, you find just on yourself. Little cuts and scratches all over the place. People don't wear flip-flops or no shoes, and they're working the fields, and they get cuts and abrasions. And just a little bit of urine in one of those is a pretty good way of getting infected.
Mm. How long did it take to... We've just described sort of the chronology of the hunt for a virus in a couple of minutes, but how many years did it take to form this deep-level understanding of Lassa fever?
Oh, 20 to 30.
Yeah. We worked there from 1976 when I first went to Sierra Leone and lived there until the early 1990s. Dr. Fischer-Hawk was one of the last people from CDC to be there before the invasion and the war that started, that kind of closed our program down. We would have probably, the CDC probably would have still been there for longer, but because of the war.
So decades. And this was a successful, understanding. I feel like that's a good reminder that should we expect to have a deeper understanding of SARS-CoV-2 anytime soon?
No. For that reason, you accumulate, groups of scientists accumulate clues over time, and you start to put together into a very good story. A good example of this is the bat story for Ebola. We didn't know where Ebola came from, but there were clues. There was a cotton factory in southern Sudan where a single room was a source of a point case, and in the roof there were lots of bats. Then it took a long time. We tried to isolate it from bats, and we failed. And then came the Marburg virus, and caves were again full of bats where primary cases were implicated. So bats got to the top of the list. Then there was this extraordinary experiment in South Africa, heroic experiment by Bob Swanepoel, who was a vet with a biosafety level 4 lab, who filled it with a menagerie from the jungle, if you please, including snakes and bats and whatever, and experimentally infected them with Ebola. They gave up on the snakes pretty quickly, actually, but the bats, 45 days out from the experiments, had more viruses in them than he had put in. This suggested it was replicating pretty well in the bats. But the bats were just fine, which is what you were looking for, an asymptomatic carrier. And so these clues started to be put together pretty slowly. And then there was a young man, Eric Leroy, in Gabon, again a vet, who followed this up and netted bets in Gabon, netted bats in Gabon, and was able to show that some of them had antibodies, and he had PCR evidence of virus. So, I mean, it takes all these, it took years and years. It takes putting these clues together to say, okay, yeah, it's bats.
I mean, you just described how slowly the pieces of the puzzle come together. But one more question about loss of fever, and then I'll refocus us for the last few minutes on COVID. But given that you, over those many decades, for loss of fever, science formed a very clear understanding of its origins, its reservoir, and how it is transmitted to human beings. Did that then translate to the eradication of loss of fever? Or, how was that knowledge put to use?
So this is unfortunate, one of those sad tales of poverty, in my opinion. This is, obviously my opinion. But we instituted a number of interesting methods to try to intervene in Sierra Leone. We had people who went out to villages to use shadow puppet shows and other methods. We had a community artist who came in from and a musician who wrote songs about preventing rodents from getting in the house, stopping contact with rodents. But the real tragedy is we developed a prototype vaccine in 1987, published all of this information. And just to this day, unlike Ebola, where there finally was a vaccine, it took more than a decade after the prototype was made. There still is no vaccine. This is a highly preventable disease using a vaccine. Why is there no vaccine? My opinion is because it's just poor people and they can't afford it. So I think the onus is on WHO and those organizations to say, look, there are probably 200,000 or 300,000 infections a year in West Africa from this virus. Why don't we have a vaccine?
So is one of the lessons then that there has never been the hunt for a virus in which politics or money hasn't intervened?
No, there has not been.
No.
And I can give you HIV as another example.
Go ahead.
You can go back centuries.
Centuries. Quickly, if you could, but go ahead.
Yeah, HIV, we did a study. So HIV was first discovered in 1981. We went to do the first, I believe it was the first thorough investigation of HIV in 1983. Now, this is before we knew what the virus was. We didn't have any idea. We just went because there were cases there. We did a thorough study 6 weeks in Kinshasa and showed that, unlike the U.S., there was a one-to-one transmission rate between men and women. So that showed there was heterogeneous. There was transmission from men to women and women to men. At that time, we isolated virus and showed it was similar to what had been finally isolated in 1984 by our colleagues in France. But there were all sorts of politics because countries started accusing each other of transmitting it. There was the fight between Dr. Gallo and the French about who discovered it, and so on and so forth. Yeah. So there has never been. And HIV was interesting because people started accusing the military of making HIV. And this actually has an implication for COVID, because one of the things we need to distinguish getting back to COVID is people are starting to think, well, this laboratory means they were trying to produce a virus that would infect people and do X, Y, or Z. Nobody knows how to do that. Nobody knows how to make any virus at this point that would that clearly would infect people and do bad things to them.
Right.
We just don't know how to do that. I don't care how many. So
we've just got 5 seconds here.
Yeah, sorry. Likelihood is that if it came, it was inadvertent.
Well, Joseph McCormick and Susan Fisher-Hawk, professors of epidemiology at the University of Texas, longtime virus hunters and co-authors of Level 4, Virus Hunters of the CDC, Tracking Ebola and the World's Deadliest Viruses. Thank you both so very much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.